have one case for argument this afternoon, Annex Books against Indianapolis. Mr. Robel.
Thank you, Judge. On remand, the trial court changed the standard. This court instructed that the city needed evidence of off-site bookstores' secondary effects. The city presented exactly that evidence. Yet the trial court raised the bar and found it was not enough. The trial court weighed the city's evidence against the plaintiff's evidence, which is not what Renton and Alameda requires. This was a mistake of law and an abuse of discretion. Specifically, this court previously found that the city failed to meet its initial burden under Renton and Alameda. The court instructed that we should have a hearing to see if we can meet that burden, and the court further reminded the city that we need not have localized proof. On remand, the city presented a published, peer-reviewed study showing that off-site bookstores have secondary effects, especially at night. This should have been enough under this court's instructions for the trial court to say that the city has now met its minimal Renton standard, that it has evidence reasonably believed to be relevant to support an hour regulation on off-site bookstores.
Could I interrupt you for a minute? Because I want to make sure that I understand one of your final arguments in the brief, and that is, are you arguing that the court could uphold the grant of a preliminary injunction for all of the plaintiffs except for Annex Books and reverse the grant just for Annex Books? Was that your argument?
Well, our argument is that this court...
Is that your argument? Oh, please just say yes or no.
Oh, yes,
I sat for six cases today, and no one would say yes or no.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And the reason why it is this court, its problem was a lack of evidence regarding the off-site stores as far as the initial burden in Renton and Alameda.
Thank you.
Okay. Instead of looking at the initial burden, the court's grant of injunction specifically weighed our evidence against the plaintiffs. This is not how Renton and Alameda Intermediate Review operates. As this court explained in GM Enterprises, Alameda Books does not require a court to reweigh the evidence considered by a legislative body, nor does it empower a court to substitute its judgment in regards to whether a regulation will best serve a community, so long as the regulatory body has satisfied the Renton requirement that it consider evidence reasonably related to be relevant to the problem addressed. The Fifth Circuit even explained that more clearly. Ultimately, we are not empowered by Alameda to second-guess the empirical assessments of the legislative body, nor are we expected to submit such assessments to a jury for reweighing. Instead, the relevant material fact that must be placed at issue is whether the ordinance is supported by the evidence that can be reasonably believed to be relevant to the problem.
You know, ignoring for a second the distinction between adult businesses and other businesses, is there any research in the field that demonstrates how crime rates differ when businesses are open rather than closed?
I don't think in our record at this point there's much. There's some definitely studies out there showing that crime rates, a lot of types of crime will rise at night. There are some types of crime that an open business will have some effect on, which I know is a big point their expert, Dr. Linz, makes. But those aren't the type of crimes we're concerned about here when we think of secondary effects. Because when we talk about secondary effects, when you look at the what's talked about in Renton and L.A. study, our studies here, they talk about prostitution, statutory rape, public exposure, sexual battery, public intoxication, drug kind of crimes. Those are what have been found in the various studies. We had over 16 secondary effects studies in our record that were listed in the original ordinance. And those aren't the kind of crimes that really, the property crimes that you look at that would be affected by a 24-hour business. Well, since the injunction, this cause has continued to go astray in the same manner because of the weighing. The court's now pushing the parties towards a battle of experts. The court has allowed a multi-million-dollar damages claim to be added to this case, going back to the original enforcement in 2005. None of this makes sense under the Renton analysis, and that's why we're back here asking this court to help us and give us some advice about how to proceed. Renton is not about weighing the city's evidence against the store. Again, it's about looking at that initial finding under Renton for whether or not there's a reasonable basis. It doesn't matter whether they can come up with a different reasonable explanation that wouldn't support the regulation, as long as we have a reasonable basis supported by evidence. And here we have a peer-reviewed, published new evidence about the secondary effects of off-site bookstores. And that's the new article by Drs. McCleary and Weinstein. Do off-site adult businesses have secondary effects?
Okay, so suppose you have bulletproof evidence from Philadelphia, Reno, Milwaukee, Albany, New York, that bookstores without on-site viewing have secondary effects on crime. But equally solid data from Indianapolis shows otherwise. What weight should the court give to the foreign data as opposed to the local data?
Well, I don't think that we get a clear answer from Renton and Alameda on that. It just says we do not need localized evidence. So I don't think there's a clear answer to that, but I think if we look at the evidence they have here, we'll realize that it's not really comparing apples to apples, because they have this study from Dr. Linz, which is dealing with two stores that aren't the four plaintiffs on appeal. The testimony from Dr. Linz shows he doesn't really know the nature of the stores, so we don't know whether we're dealing with off-site bookstores in that case. There's also problems with his data. Again, he's only looking at the UCR1 crimes, as we argue in the brief, which leaves out the normal secondary effects kind of crimes of prostitution, statutory rape, public exposure, sexual battery, public intoxication, drugs. So he's not even looking at the kind of crimes we're trying to regulate. That study's not peer-reviewed and published, so it would be less reliable. It'd be less of the kind of gold standard academic article that we have, that we are relying on. Also, it's important to...
You know, this peer reviews, reviewing of the articles, even if we were to find error in such an article, or another litigant or an amicus pointed out legitimate error, are you saying that peer-reviewed articles are unassailable by the court? Because, you know, your arguments on page 1 and 2 of the reply brief seem to posit that a court has no, has no business criticizing a peer-reviewed article.
I definitely wouldn't say unassailable, but I think it would be hard to attack one, just because they go through the academic process of having other experts in the field, experts at statistical analysis, deciding whether or not this is good enough science that can be published in the journal. So I don't think it's unassailable. But
the question that's posed is whether it's good enough science to be published in this journal. And there are an awful lot of second- and third-rate journals in the world.
That's true, Your Honor. And this one is a respected, from my understanding, academic journal, and it makes more sense for cities to be relying on this type of evidence than relying on stuff that has not gone through that review process.
What variables were controlled for in this study?
Well, I don't claim to be a great statistician, but I do know he went through with what he called a...
I don't think that's a complicated question. I'm looking at the study. It's on my screen before me. I think the answer is none.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it's true, Your Honor, because he goes through his pages where he talks about the quasi-experimental design, which I'm sure you understand that more than I do, but the explanation is that it looks at other factors, various other factors, to see whether or not they may have caused the same effect.
Now, the way in which you do that is to perform a multivariate regression. What this is a cross-tabulation. One would refer to this as the state of the art as of about 1950, before there were computers, and therefore when one had to calculate all statistics by hand or by slide rule. There aren't very many people who perform studies like this today.
Well, he also subjects it to what he called the Poisson hypothesis, which isn't that a type of regression analysis?
It's not a regression analysis.
Back to Judge Rovner's question, because I don't think I can please you, other than that it, this is the kind of, it's an academic article, so it's what a city should be relying on. Your earlier question about localized evidence, it's also important to remember we're only dealing with a very, very small study in Dr. Lin's, and there can definitely be stores that aren't going to work out what the way the city's trying to regulate, because, you know, you're regulating a whole class of businesses. Just because you have one store that doesn't have the effect doesn't prove that it's not reasonable to regulate that whole class as long as you have the evidence reasonably believed to be relevant. And I'd also add that the offsite study, it supplements the large record we already have. We already had 16 secondary effect studies, some of which did deal with bookstores. The Indianapolis study said even a relatively passive use, such as adult bookstore, can have a serious negative effect on the immediate environs. Garden Grove included bookstores. A lot of them include bookstores, but they don't define what a bookstore is. But there's no reason to suspect that this off-site distinction we're making now, that it didn't include off-site bookstores. I'm into my rebuttal time, so thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Robel. Mr. Murray.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I do represent the plaintiffs' appellees. I respectfully submit that the District Court did not abuse its discretion in granting a preliminary injunction. Rather, the District Court correctly followed this Court's template and opinion to the letter that was rendered last year.
I think that greatly overstates the extent to which our opinion can be said to be a template. You know, there's a whole passage in there that says we appreciate that we're remanding with a completely fuzzball standard and we're not entirely sure what it means, but, you know, that's what the Supreme Court has said. Yeah, to call this fuzzball a template that can be carried out is well, an overstatement.
Well, perhaps. But I did find some illuminating passages from what Your Honors wrote last year, and one of the things the court said was the city needs evidence that the restrictions on hours of operation actually have public benefits great enough to justify any curtailment of speech. And when this court reversed the summary judgment that had been granted to the city, the court found that none of the studies on which the city had previously relied concerned an hours of operation ordinance, but rather concerned dispersal ordinances.
Can I ask you that very same question that I asked?
Yes.
Mr. Robel, is there any research in the field that demonstrates how crime rates differ when businesses, and by that I mean any business, not just, you know, necessarily adult businesses, are open when they're open, you know, rather than when they're closed?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the city offered that precise evidence in this very case. This case was provided a laboratory experiment on that very issue because it enabled the city to collect crime statistics for the 3-year period before the ordinance was enforced and compare it with the 3-year period when the ordinance was enforced and the stores were closed. And that data showed, it's the city's own evidence, they offered it at the preliminary injunction hearing, it showed that crime went up significantly when, in fact, the stores were closed. And it went up far beyond what crime had gone up in the rest of the police district. During the hours of midnight to 10 a.m., during the 3-year period when these stores were closed under the ordinance, total crime went up by 29% compared to 21.
Are numbers statistically significant?
Well, I believe they are, Your Honor. The city offered them, and they are actual crime statistics.
The technical question, statistical significance, has a technical meaning. Were these numbers statistically significant?
Well, I think for purposes of at least justifying a preliminary injunction.
What was the T statistic?
None of those were calculated. I grant you that.
I don't know whether it was statistically significant.
Perhaps. I agree with that.
I'll ask you a technical question. Yes. I need a real answer rather than lawyers talk.
Okay. But the data was substantial, and it was significant, and it did show an uptick in crime.
I don't know whether it's significant. You just said you
don't
know whether
it's significant. I didn't mean in the technical sense, Your Honor. I meant in the layperson's sense. It did show that crime went up by 29% compared to 21% in the rest of the district. On Sunday, crime went up by 46% within 500 feet of the four plaintiffs, compared to only 11% in the rest of the district. It seems to me that with that kind of data, it would be difficult to say that the district court abused its discretion in simply granting a preliminary injunction pending a full trial on the merits, at which these very issues can be fleshed out, the statistical significance can be ascertained, and all of the issues can be aired. Certainly, at the very least, it seems to me that based upon this data, it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the district court to do so. And this was particularly true when one considers that this court held, and by the way, in answer to Judge Rovner's question about whether local evidence should trump a foreign study, the 11th Circuit in the Fulton County case, which we cite in our brief, held precisely that. Fulton County relied upon foreign studies, but its own studies showed that there were greater police crime incidents at neighborhood bars without adult entertainment than there were at the places that had adult entertainment. And the 11th Circuit held that it wasn't reasonable for Fulton County to rely upon foreign studies when, in fact, their own local studies demonstrated the opposite of the claimed effect that the ordinance was designed to calculate. But the other side of the equation that this court pointed out is that the city's burden was a dual burden. It wasn't just to show that the ordinance would reduce adverse secondary effects, which they didn't show, and which is at least contradicted by the preliminary data that their own police department produced. But in addition to that, this court, citing Justice Kennedy's concurrence opinion in Alameda Books and holding that that was the opinion that represented the holding of the court because his vote was necessary to make up the majority, this court pointed out that the second burden that the city has is to demonstrate not only a reduction in adverse secondary effects, but that it does so without substantially reducing the quantity of speech. Here, of course, the closing hours clearly reduce speech, and the city offered nothing to establish.
Closing hours clearly reduce speech?
Well,
they reduce the number of hours during which the bookstores are open.
Yes.
Does it follow that that reduces the amount of speech? It may just concentrate the sales in the remaining hours.
I think at least for purposes of an abuse of discretion standard.
Well, that may be true, but again, we're talking numbers. Is it your understanding that bookstores that, say, close in the evening sell the same number of books per hour as bookstores that are open 24 hours?
I think
that would be a proxy for what's going on here.
No, I think it's a reasonable conclusion to draw that some of the sales that occur between midnight and 10 a.m. or on Sunday will not be made up at other hours. Just as a matter of logic, Your Honor. I agree that some of the sales will be made up.
Look, I was asking whether you had any data, right? Real sales figures. The answer may be no. I'm making an argument as a matter of logic, and I hope it persuades. But
yes.
Is the answer to my question no, you don't have any numbers?
Not. We intend to put that on at the trial.
Okay.
At
all
the
right.
preliminary injunction
that's
stage,
fine.
Yes.
You know, we'll come up with numbers later, but it's not so clear that it would be beyond the range of the assistance of real data.
I understand that, and we intend to, when we get to the trial, we intend to put that very kind of evidence on in support of the permanent injunction. We're here, obviously, only on the preliminary ruling that the judge made based upon this court's decision plus the additional data that was put in, which consisted of the police crime statistics and this one article by Dr. McCleary. And let me speak a little bit about Dr. McCleary's article. Because I don't think it is fair to say that the district court, as a matter of law, was compelled to accept this article as sufficient to meet the city's dual burdens, particularly in the face of the contrary evidence that was contained in the police reports and the police records. But his article is seriously flawed. Number one, it dealt with a dispersal ordinance in Sioux City, Iowa. Again, not an hours of operation ordinance. Number two, it was based upon his theory that these businesses attract soft targets and predators come and victimize the customers, and that was a theory that this court debunked in the New Albany case, calling it paternalistic. So that was his theory. In addition,
an awful lot of paternalistic laws that governments enact.
Yes, but Your Honor wrote in the opinion that not when it comes to free speech. The opinion in this case stated that it's the police's job to protect the customers from the criminals rather than to require the customers from to refrain from frequenting these stores. By the way, his own study, when you look at it, showed that there were actually more crimes in the control area after Dr. John's opened than near the adult bookstore. After the store opened, there were 41 crime incidents, he reported in his article, near the adult bookstore, but there were 46 crimes in the area that had no adult bookstore. If the theory that he espoused is correct, there should be more crimes near the adult bookstore than in the area without such a store.
How adjoining are these areas that you speak of?
According to his article, he examined the 500 feet around the adult bookstore, and then he examined the 500 feet adjacent to it, in which he claimed was a comparable area to examine. So those, the control was the 500 feet further out, and the studied area was the 500 feet around Dr. John's. And he found that there was more crime in the area that didn't have the adult bookstore. The district court in that very case.
Why?
He doesn't. Well, he doesn't explain.
Well, exactly. And that's the problem with cross tabulations like this. In order to figure out whether any of these numbers is meaningful, you need to know, for example, whether a bar had opened next door and there were a lot of arrests for public drunkenness, or whether a bar opened 500 feet away. That's why you need other independent variables.
And that is.
So we can't figure out what the significance of these changes is.
And that's one of the very criticisms that the district court, the federal district court in Sioux City, said in its published opinion, rejecting Dr. McCleary's study as being one that could reasonably be relied upon. One of the very defects that the district court wrote about in Dr. McCleary's...
You know, maybe the questions I asked to Mr. Robel were not clear enough. The kind of statistical work that's being done in this article is stuff that was the state of the art 50 years ago or 55 years ago, before computers made regression analysis possible. And you rely on the best you can do. For a long time, this kind of work was the best you could do. It was the kind of thing you would rely on. But it's just not remotely the best one can do now. And that was the point I was making to Mr. Robel. I wasn't suggesting that the kind of stuff that's in this article is not reputable or no one could ever rely on it. It's just that these are comparative judgments one always has to make.
I understand, Your Honor. But one of the things I think it's important to understand in this is that in the Sioux City opinion, one of the criticisms of Dr. McCleary's study was that he didn't take into account the fact that once Dr. John's opened, there was other area changes. And in fact, bars and other businesses opened as well. And so you need to take into account whether the bars that opened at in the same area as Dr. John's might or might not be responsible for whatever criminal activity occurred. And Dr. McCleary doesn't address that in his published article, that particular criticism by the district court in Sioux City. And so it seems to me, Your Honor, and I recognize that we're going to get to a trial and we're going to put all the evidence on that hopefully that Your Honor is discussing. But at this stage, after the reversal, there was a motion to stay the enforcement of the ordinance while we went about the task of collecting that more scientific evidence. And the district court had before it your opinion, and it had before it the crime statistics from Indianapolis, and it had before it the article from Dr. McCleary, and it seems to me that there is nothing inappropriate about the district court simply staying the ordinance pending the evidentiary hearing that this court called for and ultimately will be had, at which that more complete record can be made and ultimately reviewed again by this court if necessary. And it seems to me that since we're here on that issue, that the district court did not commit any error. Now, I want to talk about Annex Books for a minute, the one store that has on-site viewing booths. This court said, in the opinion, that the city relied upon these 41 arrests there for public masturbation. But this court explained in its first opinion in this case that unless most of them were after midnight or on Sunday, they don't justify the ordinance even with respect to establishments that supply entertainment on the premises. And the court said, nor can we tell whether 41 arrests at one business over the course of 365 days is large or small, or how it compares to arrests for public urination and drunkenness at bars, which would be an appropriate comparison. And absent that kind of evidence, the city can't justify requiring First Amendment businesses to close during hours that these other businesses are open. The city did nothing to supplement the record and to provide any evidence to the district court at the preliminary injunction stage to answer any of those questions or to provide any information about whether or not those arrests occurred at what particular time. We now have evidence. It's not in the record, and we're going to present it at the our expert has discovered when those 41 arrests occurred, and we're anxious to put that on when we get to the trial. But the
no, too.
Pardon me?
I said we're anxious to know, too.
Yes. Well, he will ultimately testify that they were not during those hours.
Thank you, Mr. Murray.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Ravel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Murray was talking about weighing again and how we should get back and have a trial. And that's not what Alameda sets us out as. It has the initial burden to find out whether or not something is reasonably relied upon. And at that stage, it should be constitutional. As soon as we reach that stage, up until the point that they meet their burden to show that this was shoddy evidence, the city should be allowed to have a regulation. He mentioned the hours of operation, that regulation specifically. And this court has a long history.
Even if it's a flawed regulation? Even if it's an overbroad regulation?
Well, the standard under Alameda is that we reasonably believed that it was not an overbroad regulation, and as long as there's evidence to meet that threshold question, and that should be the analysis, not a weighing of their evidence versus ours. It should be whether or not that was a reasonable belief. They might be other reasonable beliefs from their evidence, but that does not make our reasonable belief, the legislative reasonable belief, wrong under the standards. As far as the hours of operations, this court has repeatedly, in other cases, upheld our regulations. We have the new study here, which talks about the crime being the highest at night. And aside from all that, there's the concept where the city should be allowed to concentrate its resources. And this court recognized that in Schultz v. City of Cumberland, that it might make sense because it's more expensive to police at night, or it might make sense because we have less police available at night or on Sunday. Other reasons other than just higher crime can support an hour regulation. He mentioned the Sioux City, Iowa evidence, and I'd like to address that briefly. The court did criticize it largely because there was no control yet in that. There was none of the statistical analysis that I realize this court has criticized as being outdated, but he didn't have that at all because it was what he called a quick and sloppy, quickly ready for litigation instead of the final published data that went through, was presented at the National Criminological Institute Conference, went through a couple years of anonymous peer comments by other criminologists, and went through a couple revisions before being published in an academic journal. I would also like to point out as far as that they have not presented any sales at the time in support of any evidence related to the loss of sales thus far. In relation to Annex Books, they mentioned that they probably would have evidence of showing that the crimes did not happen at night, but that kind of crime is a vice cop crime, so that happens whenever the vice cops are there because otherwise it would not be noticed. Finally, I'd like to address, he spent some time on the city's new data, and the reason why we presented that is because it did show an increase in violent crimes, aggravated assault, forcible rape, murder, robbery, but 10%, went down 10%. The rest of the city went up 8%. But there was a difference as far as the property crimes, arson, burglary, and theft. The problem with that data is we had very limited data. We didn't only have UCR1 data, which doesn't look at the main crimes we look at when we talk of secondary effects. Again, it doesn't look at prostitution, statutory rape, public exposure, sexual battery, public intoxication, drugs. And these are the kind of crimes that the Indianapolis study, Renton, Richland, Bookmart, all identified as the kind of crimes that the large secondary studies evidence allows you to regulate. And also, because we don't have any idea how reliable that study is, this data. It was the very quick data we put together as far as whether or not this basically call for service data, police reports, is reliable for time of day and place. And as we address at length in our briefs, time of day, you really can't get in place. You really can't get from call for service data. Thank you, Your Honors.
Yep. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.